All right. Hello and welcome to Oncology Decoded. We are privileged to be here in Nashville, Tennessee at World GU 2025. With me is Dr. Brad Somers from West Cancer Center and Research Institute, who's also the chairman of the practice over there. And Ben obviously is here with me as well. So today we're going to be talking about the non-histology, not the variant histology.
Variant histology. Manoj is jumbling his words. We're going to talk about what you do in clinic. We're all community providers with some focus in patients that don't have the traditional histology. And this is going to get complex. We're going to talk about kidney. We're going to talk about bladder. I hope we have a good discussion, because what's unique about this conference is we're bringing academics from traditional academia, as well as those with a focus in general urinary malignancy from the community as well, together. And then we're now talking to one of our general urinary and also a GI focused clinician at West. So I think this will be a good conversation. You've heard a lot of me and Manoj talk about this stuff before, but now we're going to talk from another kind of community specialist out there. And I think that's the purpose of what Oncology Decoded is all about. So let's start off. What do you think, kidney or bladder?
Why don't we start with prostate first?
Ooh, prostate. Okay.
Curveball right
here. Okay. Something we weren't prepared for. That's what Manoj is here for. So go ahead.
So, Dr. Somers, why don't you tell us how you approach patients who have variant histology prostate cancers? How do you think about it? What is variant histology? Let's set the basics for prostate cancer.
I think in any of these cancers, variant histology is where it's you got your bread and butter, and that probably constitutes whatever, let's say 80%, 90% of your practice is going to be those traditional histologies. It may be in kidney, it might be more like 60%, so whatever. But the point is that there are then these ones that are very unique, and those are more challenging, but they're also, they're more challenging because we don't have a lot of guidance. The literature is just much more sparse, and I think there's, but also opportunity, because I think that there's just so much curiosity in these cancers that make it a lot more exciting as to investigate and to look at. And I think it also like a little bit levels the playing field, because no one has that much experience in like you pick your type of variant histology prostate cancer in this case,
like let's say small cell prostate cancer.
Yeah,
small cell prostate. How many does anybody see, right? Like even if you're a very busy GU oncologist, how much does anybody see?
That's a great point. Yeah, probably see maybe 4 a year.
Oof, me probably 8 to 12. But of course we have clinical trials for that. So it's a little bit different, you know, and I think when we think about prostate, yeah, that's fair. That's what I do. That's why I'm in the middle. I think when we think about prostate cancer, I don't think we're going to talk about that at World GU 25 today. I think that, you know, in the sessions that both of you are a part of, but I think, you know, small cell neuroendocrine differentiation, I think there's a difference, right? And I treat those differently. In small cell, I'm really thinking platinum, etoposide, and immunotherapy, and kind of borrowing from that small cell lung, small cell bladder, small cell of other organ. Now, the neuroendocrine differentiation, I treat a little bit differently, and maybe I'm on an island there.
Well,
how do you handle that?
If you think about it, it's like, yeah, neuroendocrine differentiation is like something that's become treatment emergent and has become, right? So that's a little bit different. And also there's a variation in terms of how aggressive that they are, right? So, you know, you have those classic small cell metastatic prostate cancer. It's a little bit different than neuroendocrine features. It's quite different, right, in terms of their behavior. And those ones that are real small cell, you really have to, in the community, you're really borrowing from small cell of the lung, which is what you see. And I think it's that case in like and almost any small cell wherever you have it, right?
And that's actually in the NCCN guidelines to go to the lung guidelines as well.
Right.
Go ahead, Manoj.
I was going to ask, how do you approach those that say the pathology reports say adenocarcinoma with like small cell features or neuroendocrine features?
So right? I feel like we don't have. So number one is get the path right, right? Because like at the end of the day, I feel like we're missing. It's not standard to check necessarily for neuroendocrine markers on your. And so I feel like the pathologists sometimes are not in every patient that has metastatic prostate cancer, or certainly more heavily treated metastatic prostate cancer, they're not necessarily always looking for those neuroendocrine features all the time. So if they're staining, you know, synaptophysin, chromogranin, those kinds of things, or, you know, there's specific pathologic inclusion that in your trials, you know, obviously there's these, you know, the trials have specific inclusion. We're not always checking for that in our pathology specimen. So the first step in my mind is get the path right. So I think you got to, like, basically, if you're, when you're screening for trials, you're going to be much more cognizant to do that kind of thing. And we've had neuroendocrine feature prostate cancer studies too, where we've trained our pathology, we have in-house pathology to actually stain and look and be thinking about that. Because if you get that, first thing is you're going to miss it, right? So that I think is the first step, is get it right.
So let me ask a very practical question. So let's say you have the patients that have small cell histology for prostate cancer. Are you going to ever treat these patients with ADT at all? Or would you just say that we're never going to use ADT and we're just going to use platinum-based therapy and then perhaps immunotherapy afterwards?
So my personal, from what I've seen, some of these patients, many of these patients have been on ADT and then they pop up and they get these small cell eruption, so to speak. So those are already on ADT, and are you going to stop the ADT? I mean, it's obviously, you know, a lot of heterogeneity in many of these metastatic prostate cancers, and you probably will stick on ADT, but if someone is miserable on ADT, can you cut back off of ADT? I think that I've certainly negotiated with patients on those, because it's not like ADT is always that fun to be on. So
I think this is a great point, and I think I struggle with it from a theoretical standpoint, right? Because we're putting patients on ADT, which is causing side effects, but also potentially pushing those cells more into a neuroendocrine small cell phenotype as we're selecting out for which cells are going to be in the dominant pattern within that patient. So I am remaining them generally on ADT, but I'm nervous that that's not the right thing to do. We just don't have good data to support it. And of course, if we pull off the ADT, maybe now we also have small cell as well as traditional adenocarcinoma variants that we have to worry about within, and it makes them more heterogeneous.
If you have an ARV7 variant or something like that, would you stop them off? They've got this crazy neuroendocrine, then, you know, you might be more apt to, but.
So really interesting. I haven't done ARV7 testing in a long time. You know, we talked about ARV7 probably about 6-7 years ago and was coming more to light, saying you should do this to figure out, are they resistant or not? And do you want to continue on ADT or not? And then kind of like died away in the community. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hasn't really been done. So I haven't really been doing ARV7 testing, but that's an interesting.
But have you been finding them when you send liquid? Like, in other words, yes, we used to like check ARV7 specific tests.
Yeah.
But, you know, now like you're testing possibly even serially for ctDNA to see if there's treatment emergent mutations, and you know, so one, you'll see sometimes those pop up, and do you know what they mean? Like, do you really know what that, it's a different test than in those initial studies, but do you know what that means if you find it in a, you know, in a ctDNA, or you do a tissue specimen and you see that, you know, how do you kind of like interpret those things?
I
always discuss it at our molecular tumor board, but
I'll say the liquid sometimes misses them too. Unlike the AR ligand binding domain mutations, which it seems to do a very good job of, I think sometimes it doesn't pick up on as much of the splice variants. I think that's a challenge in the world we're moving into within oncology.
So let me ask you guys a very practical question, right? If you have a new patient that's diagnosed treatment naive, because generally you think about small cell as those, you know, as we were talking about earlier, that have been on ADT therapy, and then now you push the disease into a different category because you're changing it. But if you have a new patient that's now diagnosed with localized and prostate cancer, but the biopsy shows up as small cell prostate cancer, are those patients that you're going to say, we're going to do traditional modality of surgery, or are you going to say we're going to do ADT radiation, or are you going to approach them as a true lung cancer and then say maybe chemo and then kind of see what happens? Like, what? How are you approaching that?
That's, well, so first step, and this is, I think it's a challenge in community in general. So you're touching on something that I think is a challenge for community oncology, because number one, not every community oncologist is specialized. Number two, not all of them have a strong multidisciplinary, center or program. Number two, they don't necessarily have GU tumor boards that meet every week, like probably we do. So you know, these are things, and usually I'm like, okay, well, we treat them in community oncology, and I'm diehard community oncology, but these are ones that really probably need those components in order to really think through those issues. And, you know, I'll check for, and those are, that will be a multimodality discussion that we would have a multidisciplinary, we presented at tumor board, and we kind of go back and forth. Ultimately, probably would give chemotherapy and probably radiation, you know, in localized disease, but you'd certainly work it up and you'd probably do an FDG PET and, you know, maybe scan the head, and like, it'd be different than what you, how you would look at your traditional prostate cancer.
Yeah, I personally think you might want to think of it like a limited stage small cell lung cancer, right? With that kind of chemo radiation approach, appropriate staging, etc. But again, this is something we see a lot of small cells that are de novo metastatic. We don't see so many that are localized in prostate. I do think we do see more that are localized in bladder, and maybe that's a good segue into bladder cancer, right? I will say before we segue, neuroendocrine prostate cancer, that's differentiated from adenocarcinoma. While I said I give a lot of platinum etoposide for small cell, I do lean more on the platinum taxane combinations in some of those patients. I don't know if you guys do the same. I'm getting a nod over here and a nod over here. So then we take the segue back to urothelial and start talking about
that.
Okay, go ahead.
Genetic sequencing. Are you doing your genetic sequencing the same in your small cell ovarian histologies as opposed to the traditional?
I do. I mean, we generally speaking, any advanced disease or aggressive disease, we would do, and certainly any varying histology disease, we would do tissue and liquid, like that, and germline testing also, probably in someone with advanced prostate. So like that would be kind of our general institutional approach to these things.
I totally agree. I mean, we do the same thing, so great. But yes, we segue into bladder.
Moving into bladder, which we're going to have some more conversation on today at this conference. You know, let's think about what kind of variants we want to talk about. There's papillary variants, there's plasmacytoid variants, there's small cell variants, right? There's others that I'm not even talking about as well. Adenocarcinoma.
We're fortunate. We have a GU and GU.
Yeah, there we go. You're a good point. So, you know, I think we can think about these buckets in two different ways, right? So, first of all, I think metastatic is the easier one to chew on. In metastatic patients, I think we can all agree that the small cell patients are getting small cell regimens. And we can move on from there. We just discussed it in prostate cancer. But then thinking about the difference potentially between a traditional urothelial versus a plasmacytoid versus a papillary or micropapillary, are you putting any distinction between those, or is everyone getting a Nectin-4 ADC immunotherapy combination?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that obviously when you look at data in those, you're looking at really small numbers. I mean, so you're really like, you're going, you know, off into a space that like, I think that I wouldn't say it's like coin tossing, but like, it's a shame that we, you know, you're talking about single institution, like maybe low double digit or single digit numbers on a lot of these studies. So you really aren't guided. You really are not guided into that, something like that. So, you know, I think that it probably somewhat depends on the pathology. I don't know what Nectin-4 expression would be in some of those true variant histologies. I would definitely sequence. And would you go with traditional? I would definitely do chemo, some kind of chemo, and combine with immunotherapy. I think that that's a reasonable approach. The question is, would you do an ADC or would you use traditional platinum-based chemotherapy with a IO? And I think that that's probably the discussion. Like,
yeah.
That's interesting. I think the only histology where I would be hesitant with ADCs is adeno.
Yeah.
So adeno, generally speaking, I would not use a Nectin-4 ADC. I probably agree with you exactly, which is chemo with or without immunotherapy.
Right.
But the adenos, you tend to think more making sure that there's no metastatic disease, but...
Yeah, no, I agree. I think adeno, I think you're right. I mean, I think when you sequence the adenos, and you'll see, like, a lot of the times you will see, like, kind of GI lineage, or even on histology, there could be GI, the pathologist may say, hey, this looks like classic GI, you know, adenocarcinoma. So, like, so does that mean you treat based on biology or histology or based on where it's arising from, anatomical, where it's arising from? And those do, we do oftentimes kind of take from the GI space into
Absolutely.
The cancers. So I think that, you know, and in those, would you give immunotherapy even in that kind of a situation? Maybe not. Like, you probably...
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we give the GI-based regimens, and I think the immunotherapy one is more questionable, and I don't think any of us have the answers there. We have phase two data sets, and these phase two data sets are quite small and not perfect. And going back to the other variants that are a little bit more common than adeno, I think papillary, we all see, anyone who sees a decent number of bladder cancer will see papillary, and we do know that Nectin-4 is expressed on papillary. I think there was some controversy around plasmacytoid. At some of the other conferences, some saying that they have relatively less expression, but others saying maybe they do have expression. I personally treated plasmacytoid patients with enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab with success. So for me, while I agree there's a lot of question marks about what we should do and what is best, to simplify it, I think if they don't have adeno or small cell or neuroendocrine, I am leaning mostly on enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab in that space. But I would admit that I don't have the data that necessarily drives me that, because we don't have a comparison study against, say, a platinum combination chemotherapy with immunotherapy regimen.
So I'm actually doing something different. So.
I love that. And Manoj is right.
No. So I've actually gone the other way, where I've...
Okay. You won't be wrong.
I won't be wrong. So I've actually used chemo immunotherapy, so mostly Gemcis Nevo. So I've
okay.
So several patients that I've treated with plasmacytoid, I've done that, and I've they've done really well. So I think you make the argument. I think it's the more immunotherapy that's probably making a difference than your chemo arm, perhaps. But I don't know.
Well, so I think you have to look at the biology, right? Like, you have to look. What other mutations are going on? Are they HER2 overexpressed?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Do they have an FGFR3 right. mutation? Those kinds of things, I think, are important in this equation. And I think that in that those kinds of situations, like, you know, I think HER2 is an exciting space in this, that we're just way behind in terms of where we're at as a field in that area. But hopefully it'll catch up quickly.
So let me ask you, HER2 we know is a dynamic marker, right? So how often are you testing for HER2?
Always.
Always.
That's not necessarily in localized disease.
So in metastatic setting,
yeah.
How often are you testing?
Everyone. Ms.
Parker. No, but just no. Once throughout the treatment course? Or?
Oh, you're saying, do you check that? Oh, is this
yes.
dynamic? You're asking. Yeah. I think on progression, at least at a minimum, I would do liquid. The question is, would you re-biopsy? And I think if there's some... you know, change that I have a question, or I don't know that I'd get tissue every time, but some clinical thing change or something easy to reach, and upon progression, probably. Especially, I mean, there's actually, like, you know, FDA approved, like, HER2,
yep.
you know, HER2 positive treatment that you could absolutely take. The question is, what do you do if it's like HER2 low, ultra low? Are you kind of like really going to like bend the rules in that? That I think is... Yeah,
I would advocate that, you know, then 3+ we have an FDA approval, and 2+ there's actually data in that study. The response rates are lower than the 3+, but they're still pretty good when we compare what else is out there. You know, they're in the 30-ish, 35% range. So I think that's all reasonable. I think going lower in urothelial, we'd need to see a little bit more data, but I think we should be exploring that, because what are our alternatives in a subsequent line setting? Going back to retesting, I'm not doing that so often. Maybe I should be. You're telling me I need to be doing that?
I mean, yeah. That's why I'm asking, right? I think we all have different practices.
Yeah.
I'll retest it probably, you know, if 6 months have gone by, then I'll retest it.
Yeah.
But if 6 months hasn't gone by, I mean, I probably won't. And that's completely arbitrary. It's not, there's no guideline on saying when you retest, right? But if someone's progressing incredibly fast, then I'll test them more often.
That's a great point. And I think now that, you know, thinking about muscle invasive disease and perioperative care and urothelial carcinoma, I think in small cell and neuroendocrine, going back to the most aggressive stuff, we are giving full systemic therapy and then seeing what happens and then trying to consolidate with radiation for most patients. Maybe you guys are doing cystectomies. That would be totally reasonable. We just don't really know. But I think the challenge that comes up with our urology colleagues is not the small cell and the neuroendocrine patients. It's the plasmacytoids. It's these other variants. Should we be delaying the cystectomy, right? Because a urologist's nightmare is when we do something that prevents them from potentially a curative surgery, Or should we be continuing on, say, the Niagara paradigm, which is the most recent new kid on the block, FDA-approved cisgem and durvalumab, which did allow ovarian histology on that phase 3 global study. So what are you doing in variant muscle invasive urothelial?
I would say that, I've adopted Niagara like everybody, I think. Is there a variant histology that you would go to, like, does Sensenvec? Not on the top of my mind.
Not on the top of mine either, though. It's a good thought.
Yeah, it's a good thought. But I do think, to your point in general, with getting to, you know, urologists and cystectomy and everything like that, most urologists in the community don't want to do cystectomies anyway. It's really going to centers, at least in our community. Like, it's going to centers that do the cystectomies. And most patients don't want cystectomies. So the question is, who do we not have to do cystectomies on, and how do we get there? And I think that's not for this podcast, but I think it's something that we need to think about, because definitely I know in the GI space for rectal cancer, it's way ahead in that area, right? I mean, like, you know, TNT is like standard of care, right?
Yeah. I think we're going to be talking, hopefully, with Dr. Chang later about that topic here at World GU25. Good. So stay tuned to your podcast,
I'm going to listen closely to that podcast.
You know, for the variant histologies, even when talking about the micropapillaries and those things, we know that these patients, it's a snapshot, right? You don't know the entire area of what this actually looks like, given that it is muscle invasive, or sometimes it's even deeper than that, right? And so I tend to favor neoadjuvant therapy if they are a very fit patient. I mean, I'm probably overtreating. That's very much the case. Yeah. It could be. But if you have a young, fit patient where you know that this biology can be quite aggressive and your best option is to downstage and then get them to surgery, I don't know. I think that's probably a better
approach. I totally agree with you 100%. And I don't know whether it's like based on data or because like personal, like literally in the past month, I had a patient with micropapillary who had T1 disease, got BCG, then got rescoped T1 disease, and they called BCG unresponsive. He's 50 years old. They took out his bladder and it's like T4 disease. And like, then we reimage him and it's only like 2-3 weeks later and he's got like metastatic disease, like localized metastatic disease, but it's like outside. So these don't behave like you would, like normal, like you would expect, right? So you really have to, again, this is something that like this requires in a community. Number one, I think some specialization that I think to think through these issues, because I think a lot of community oncology don't really understand the nuance with it. And number two, a really good multidisciplinary, multidisciplinary program.
I'll say what I do. You know, I'm giving cisgem durva for almost all these variants, right? Squamous, papillary, plasmacytoid. The one thing I do differently in conjunction with my surgeons who are not part of our practice, right? They're part of a separate practice. We practice in the community. That's one of the challenges. But is instead of doing 4 cycles, we do 2 cycles and then a scope. Mm-hmm. And we make sure that disease is responding, not getting worse. That way, if it is getting worse, we can get a quick CT scan and maybe still take them to surgery with a curative intent. That's the only thing that's a little pearl that we're doing in Nashville.
I like that. We generally just go the full 4 cycles, yeah, and then reassess. I'll get a scan, but I don't do a cysto at halfway through. That's, you know, as you always say, I'm always learning.
Yeah, it's a great. It's the Nashville GU pearl there. And I think we haven't talked about kidney, right? Are we ready for that? You got one other question?
Okay. How do you deal with the percentage, right? So if you say, if you have it says transitional cell with squamous or with micropapillary, how do you approach that?
So my personal take on it, that mixed histology is more simple than the pure histology, because you know there's a clearly urothelial component, and I kind of go with the urothelial and the rest follows. That's generally speaking, like, it is the way that I would kind of pursue. But when you have these like pure squames, you know, or some of these pure, you know, it's a little more challenging because you have no numbers. Like, you really have low anecdotal data to go by.
What do you do in that back case, man?
It doesn't change my treatment. As I said, I'm in the perioperative setting relying on cisgem durva, and in the metastatic setting, I'm relying on EV pembro for the most part. I'm just watching them a little bit more closely because they're a little bit more unpredictable. But that's what I'm doing. And I also know, and I feel there's some data out there that suggests relative consistent Nectin-4, relative consistent HER2, and relative consistent TROP2 expression across most of these variants. So I feel like while, of course, we don't have great numbers in those data sets, at least you know that the ADC might be able to target a lot of these different variants. I think that's another critical component.
And there's still that lineage that still stays with it, yeah. Fair?
I'm ready for kidney.
All right, kidney. Okay, so let's focus just on metastatic kidney for the sake of time, but also for the sake of, we don't do a lot of perioperative kidney care outside of adjuvant immunotherapy, and we'll just say adjuvant immunotherapy is approved in clear cell or clear cell with sarcomatoid features, right?
I want to plug in that we did have a fantastic talk earlier about adjuvant therapies and variant histologies in kidney cancer.
Very true. And things are evolving in that space fast.
They are.
And moving into the metastatic setting, right? Clear cell, 70-ish, 75% of patients. Papillary, 10 to 15-ish percent of patients. Technically, there's multiple types of papillary. There's the MET-driven and the non-MET-driven, but okay, that's a great conversation. I don't think it's clinically actionable. There's chromophobe, 5 to 10%, right? There's collecting duct, there's translocation, there's a lot of things, right? RMCC, etc. So when we get these patients, I think we know the renal medullary patients, those are different. Those need to be in a center that treats that. That's I'm a big community oncology advocate, but those probably need to be at a place where they have registries. Those need actual cytotoxic chemotherapy. Those are not, the types of let's figure out which TKI we want to use, right? But if we go to the other ones, I think it's kind of more complicated. So metastatic frontline immunotherapy doublet, immunotherapy TKI combination, how are you viewing that?
So that's a tricky question because, again, in this kind of situation, we have a lot of tools. And, we could talk about IO-IO versus IO TKI and clear cell for like 4 hours probably. And you've certainly heard podcasts and discussed that for hours. And it's a big academic discussion. You can't have that real big academic discussion on it because, for the most part, there's inconsistent data. You're talking about very low numbers. You could have a discussion on what's the most important thing, response rate or, progression-free survival or whatever, or, how they tolerate it, whatever. I mean, these are like questions, but you're talking about like in chromophobe, single digit series that are a single institution, and you're basically, so you're a little bit hedging. The question is you kind of go off into what should I not do? Like, should I not, don't do single agent VEGF inhibitor, for example, or, single agent immunotherapy. That's not likely to really have any benefit. But, certainly if you go a classic VEGF inhibitor with an IO, I think you have to look at all of these histologies separately and individually and the biology separately and individually. The main thing in the community is the scary part is not to miss, like not everybody knows everything. So you have to know what to look for. So you have to look for fumarate hydratase.
Yes.
Because if you have a mutation in that, then, they actually do respond and respond well to a VEGF inhibition with the EGFR inhibitor. So, you know what not to miss, and you have to look for genetic mutations in people so that you can help screen for their families. And these are the things that you really need to be thinking about. But in terms of which VEGF VEGF IO combo, Lenpem is it's good, there's good, at least in many of these histologies seem to be activity, and Len-Ev and maybe in chromophobe or, but again, these are like with an asterisk.
Yeah.
Not a lot of data. And what we really need in the community is like not just our own individual experience, not just our tumor board experience, not just us conversing, but we need like real world data, because real world data is really in these kinds of situations is going to be the only way that we can really make a difference, because they're just getting treated like all over. And oftentimes, if they're getting treated in the community, they're not even like really appreciating the difference in these histologies even. So if we can get, you know, the computer systems to pull that out and really get our real world data out of that, then we can probably make a difference.
I think that's a great point, and something that is a problem with our computer system, because ICD-10 codes don't capture variant histologies. Right. And that has been a huge barrier for some of these projects. And I agree with you. We have small numbers. I like to think of the cabozantinib nivolumabs, the lenvatinib pembrolizumabs as great options. I like to think of ipi-nivo having potentially a role as well, based on SUNY forecast last year, which we discussed in one of our previous podcast episodes. So Dr. Stephanie Berg was on that episode. If you want to scroll up in your podcast feed, I think that was an excellent conversation. And I think you're right. I think we just need to find a way to use the volume of patients, 80% of patients in the community. And how do we learn from that experience? How can we combine our data sets and really answer the question once and for all about how to treat these histologies differently?
That's your next project, Matt.
Yeah, there we go.
It's like at the end of the day, you can have a variant histology clinical trial, but you're not going to accrue in any...
You're not going to accrue in any one individual center.
Right.
You really need very large studies in order to make that happen.
It takes commitment and someone to sponsor. And
money, dollars, and also the willingness to miss a primary endpoint. If we're going to randomize against, you know, two different drugs, we want to randomize against very active ones. And that's I think, always a challenge as well. You know, not randomizing against a global standard of care, but in America, us really focusing on doublets in these patients, I think has also stalled potentially the development of drugs in this space.
Well, we'll see some exciting data that'll come in, you know, so we have more to look forward to.
We have
to.
Zanzalintinib combinations, and we also have another MET inhibitor combination that Ben Mon, who's at this conference, is running in the quadro group. So a lot of interesting data.
I mean, in general, like these MET inhibitors in other areas have found success, and they've found ways to target MET, you know, and can that be applicable here? Smaller numbers, you know, harder to get these trials done, but they have to get done. I mean, they have to. We have to push forward as a community.
Great.
I think with that, we can conclude and say thank you. This was an excellent podcast. I hope everyone listening today or watching today on your screens found it informative. I think it's always good when us community folks can get together across practices and discuss, you know, kind of shared similarities and differences. And of course, we had some differences today, and maybe we'll learn from those here. I know I am thinking about dynamic HER2. Do I got to start biopsying more people now? Maybe I do.
I think you guys are doing great stuff, great work. I think that when you focus really on the community, I mean, we're in Memphis. It's hard for patients to travel to big centers, you know, also like vast majority of patients are going to get treated in the community.
Absolutely.
You know, at the end of the day, and it's like you know, you can deal with all the data, you know, and kind of like flush that all through. But at the end of the day, it's the patient in front of us that really we have to be able to manage and be able to manage it well and with the highest quality. And you guys, congrats on your new endeavor and keep doing great stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you. Be sure to follow us on X at Oncology Decoded. And email us at podcast@oncologydecoded.com. Look forward to hearing from you. And thank you all for your encouragement and support.
Thank you.
Thanks.